I'm Stu Schneller, Dean of the College of Sciences and Mathematics, and I'm pleased to welcome you to Podcasting with the Dean, episode number 12 for the week of September 14. It's been a beautiful 2 weeks, last couple of weeks in Auburn. The weather has seemed to become a little bit milder for us in this time of the year. The students are back and invigorated the campus. I've mentioned this before, and I'm sure you've navigated and know this now, but you do not need an iPod to play these podcasts. You can play them directly from your computer. And I also encourage you to go to our show notes. There's follow-ups to our speakers, and we'll be getting to that at the end of this podcast today. As I think we all know, outstanding universities are built by outstanding faculty, the reputation of faculty. It all begins with faculty. Students are attracted to universities by faculty. The student-faculty relationship becomes very symbiotic. And I think there's nothing that makes a dean prouder than to be able to talk to faculty about their classroom activities, their research, and their outreach. And I'm pleased to have with at this podcast today Dr. Jeff Hill, who is a professor in the Department of Biological Sciences. And Jeff certainly meets all those expectations that I myself as a dean enjoy talking to faculty about. So, Jeff, we welcome you to the podcast today. I think our audience would appreciate knowing a little bit about yourself. If you could give us a brief autobiographical sketch of your career up to now, we'll then follow from there.
Oh, sure, I'd be happy to. I grew up near Cincinnati on the Kentucky side of the river in Fort Mitchell, Kentucky. Did my undergraduate work at Indiana University, which really isn't very far from those Cincinnati suburbs. After I finished my bachelor's, I already had a strong interest in birds and natural history and evolution. So I went out to the University of New Mexico, which had a nice program in behavior, evolution, and ecology. Got my master's degree at the University of New Mexico. Moved on to the University of Michigan, which has an outstanding program in organismal biology, a big museum. And there I received my doctorate. Then, of course, I was looking for a job, and I took a postdoctoral position, which is a temporary position between getting a PhD and getting a permanent job. That was in Canada, so I got to live outside the U.S., not very far. I think we were 70 miles from the border, but it was a little bit of international experience. It was in Canada at Queen's University for 2 years, and then took my first and only job post here at Auburn in 1993.
Well, Jeff, you and I have a little more in common than I first thought. I grew up in Kentucky myself, in Louisville, Kentucky, and
been just down the highway. Yeah, we barely thought of ourselves as Kentuckians because all of our news came from Ohio, so that's we were in the Cincinnati suburbs. But yeah, we voted in the Kentucky elections, and we took our field trips down to Frankfort, so it was Kentuckians.
You had to go to the state capitol, so went to Frankfort. Yeah. And then I don't know how far is the Cincinnati airport. It's in Kentucky.
It was actually so close to my house. We were irritated by the low-flying planes. Yeah, because people that don't live in that part of the country may not realize, but the Cincinnati airport's in Kentucky.
Yeah, yeah.
It's so crowded on the Ohio side of the river. They put it over on the Kentucky side of the river.
And then I went to IU for my PhD. So I went from Louisville to Bloomington, and you went from Fort Mitchell to Bloomington for different reasons.
I find a lot of similarities between Indiana and Alabama. And IU and Auburn, I think, share a lot. Even though Indiana, I think Purdue's a land-grant university state, but it has the same kind of community, and it has a very enthusiastic student body. So I've actually getting to Auburn felt a lot like home, having come from an undergraduate start at Indiana.
Both college towns. I haven't been back to
maybe
IU.
That's what it was. The IU college quite town a while. Atmosphere.
When I was there, they had a very prominent music program, and so I would go. I was married before I left my PhD, so my wife and I would go to as much music as we can. Well, we'll save talking about IU for another time, but. So I maybe you can comment a little bit about the courses you teach. Our listeners are always interested in what faculty, how they, in what classroom activities they engage our students.
Well, I teach several graduate courses, which would have small enrollment and be specialized courses. Occasionally undergraduates will take those, but mostly those are for graduates and specialized topics, advanced studies in evolution and animal coloration. But my main teaching duty at the undergraduate level is ornithology, and that's always been a huge pleasure for me to be able to teach something that I just enjoy so much. And that class has a large enrollment. We've been running at about 50 students in ornithology for the last 5 years or so, and these are almost all students that have a real interest in natural history. So they're either taking it as an elective or part of a major in wildlife sciences, and it's just fun to be out with a lot of young, enthusiastic people. That course has a field component. We have our lecture, and then we also have a laboratory, and the laboratory is mostly teaching them how to go out with binoculars and identify birds. So again, that's something that I enjoy a lot. So it's a great class to teach.
Do you go out just in the Auburn area for that field?
Yeah, we're limited. It's a 3-hour lab. When I first got here, we would try to make a run down to Eufaula National Wildlife Refuge, which is about an hour away. But that wasn't really realistic. If you're driving 2 hours for a 3-hour lab, you don't get to see very much. So we've found the good spots around Auburn. So yeah, we go to the sewage ponds in Opelika, and we go to the abandoned fields and stuff on campus, and you can actually find quite a good diversity of birds right within 20 minutes drive around Auburn.
Is that course taught, is it seasonal? Is there certain semesters that are better for the
students?
Yeah,
and luckily it's always been a spring course as long as I've been here. And you know, Alabama has a great climate for teaching ornithology. I talk to my colleagues up in Maine or Michigan or Minnesota, and it's miserable. They have, I don't know, 80 or 90% of the class is frozen landscape. They see almost nothing. Then they get 1 or 2 good weeks of bird watching, and the semester's over.
Yeah.
Here, the winters are beautiful. We have all these wintering birds come down and spend the winter in Alabama because of the nice climate. And so we have started from day one in January, we're seeing lots of birds. And then we get the spring migrants really early. The birds that will be in Minnesota in May are here in early April. Mm-hmm. And so it's a great course. I teach a winter identification, and then all the birds change with migration, and then
that's
we
neat.
Teach spring identification. So
that's neat.
It's been a great place to teach ornithology.
Yeah. And so do your students see the birds? Do they hear the sounds too? I mean, is that part
yeah,
of it?
Yeah, we try hard. You know, the little birds in the bushes drive them crazy. Mm-hmm. But using binoculars is a real skill. It takes some practice to be able to see a bird in a tree or bush and then put the binoculars to your face and relocate the bird in the binoculars. Mm-hmm. So we just have to train them on that. But yeah, as best we can, we get them on the birds. Of course, in the winter, we do some weekend field trips, and we go all the way down to the coast on a weekend field trip. So there, the birds are spectacular.
Oh, I bet.
It's hard to miss the big flocks of birds you get in those areas. So,
I know your research also is very field oriented, and I'm sure most of our listeners know your name because you gained a lot of publicity in COSAM too in your ivory bill research, but. Maybe you could comment on that too, but talk about your research in general, and then let's get to the ivory bill and maybe your work in coloration.
Yeah, my core research, the research that I got hired at Auburn to do really is relates to the coloration of birds. And it seems like a very specialized topic, but it's taken me into all sorts of what we think of as more mainstream biological studies. So in just trying to figure out why finches have red feathers, say, I've had to get involved in research on the immunology, endocrinology, biogeography, how these birds distribute across the surface in North America, a variety of topics. And so students and I have worked for 20 years on bird coloration, and we feel like we've barely scratched the surface. And that entails both going out into the field with binoculars and putting up nets and catching birds, putting rings on their legs so we can follow individuals through their reproductive cycle, see what things affect reproduction. But also, from the beginning, it's had a substantial lab component. And we, I now have a really nice state-of-the-art molecular lab over in the life science building. So we can do what are generally considered pretty simple molecular techniques, such as determining the sex of males and females. If they don't have distinguishing plumages, there's simple little molecular markers now. But we can also do paternity analysis, and that's been central to a lot of my research, where we to really understand how birds are doing in a reproductive sense, how they're faring in terms of propagating themselves. You have to know which offspring are really theirs and which might not mm-hmm. really be theirs. Just because a young comes out of a nest doesn't mean, say, the father, the male bird attending that nest is the father of the birds. So we use microsatellites, these simple genetic markers, to link parents and offspring. And this is the same technique that was developed in forensic sciences for paternity analysis and crime scene analysis in humans. So that was adopted to field ornithology decades ago, and we do that in my lab. But lately we've gotten into to more advanced genetic studies using some of the new and powerful techniques like gene expression to test some fundamental ideas about what sort of things might be signaled by the coloration of a bird's feathers. And to me, this has been really exciting to bring some of the powerful new genetics techniques to good old field ornithology and really push the field ahead.
Why finches for coloration? I mean, what's unique about the finch?
Well, I think it's the commonness and ease of study. So in field ornithology, some people pick the rarest and most exotic bird to study because you get to go to exotic places mm-hmm. and study them. And I feel that allure too. But, you know, really to try to gain some basic understanding of how nature works, you're better off focusing on some of the more common and abundant species and species that do well in cages, for instance, so that you can really do the sorts of experiments and studies that you need to do. And so the house finch has been one of our model organisms because it's very abundant. It's the bird that will come to your feeder at your deck, one of the very first birds, mm-hmm. and in greatest abundance, so we can catch them. We don't harm native populations by taking a few dozen for study in aviaries. You can bring them into cages, and they do just fine eating seeds. And so it's been – we chose that bird really for ease of study. And then the house finch has nice red feather coloration, mm-hmm. and that's been a focus of our research.
What's the range of the finch you study?
That bird has an interesting range and history of range. That's a bird that was native to the western states from the Colorado Rockies west. But in the 1940s, it was brought over and released in the New York City area. Mm-hmm. It was actually an accidental release of cage birds that established a population in the New York City area that spread and filled in the whole eastern portion of the continent, so that now that bird is common in all the lower 48 states and Hawaii. It was released out in Hawaii, too. So it's one of the most common birds in every state but Alaska.
We'll get back to the ivory bill in a second, but what about diseases? We often don't think of – I mean, West Nile brought – I think avian disease and certainly some of the flu viruses, you know, or get that. But I mean, what about wild birds and the finch, since you've studied, do they carry diseases? Or are they susceptible?
Yeah, I think every animal on earth has diseases. Even bacteria have diseases.
Yeah,
so, everything has its parasites and diseases. So certainly birds do. And disease research has actually been a focus of my research for quite a while now. And it started with an interest in how diseases affect the coloration. A lot of what I study related to the red coloration in finches is how it can serve as a signal, how it can encode things about the individual that other birds mm-hmm. could perceive. And so health state is one of the things that we've focused on. And so for years now, we've been studying how parasites, everything from viruses to ticks, can affect the color of these birds. Mm-hmm. And then about a little over 10 years ago, in the 96 or so, a new bird disease appeared in Maryland. And this didn't get a whole lot of press. It got a little bit of press because it was not a human event. It really had no impact on humans. It had no impact on agriculture. But it was one of the most terrible wildlife diseases we've witnessed in North America. This bacterial infection was found in the respiratory tract and the eyes of some house finches in Maryland. And in just a few years, this disease swept across the eastern part of the continent, killed probably a quarter of a billion finches as it moved across, and dropped the population by half. And this was a very abundant bird.
Mm-hmm.
And we actually got in early on a study of that disease. And that particular disease, it's a mycoplasma. It's called Mycoplasma gallisepticum. Mm-hmm. Has been the source of a lot of research. And this new research I talked about using the new cutting-edge techniques mm-hmm. is actually a test of whether plumage coloration might signal good genes mm-hmm. In house finches. Mm-hmm. So this idea is that when a female chooses a male and chooses a male based on the brightness of his feathers, scientists have wondered, well, what would a female get out of that? I mean, mm-hmm. just having a pretty male doesn't really get you anything in terms of reproductive yeah. success or strong uh-huh. offspring. But one idea is that if your genetic makeup determines how well you can fend off parasites, and then that shows up in the brightness mm-hmm. of your plumage, by choosing bright feathers, they could choose a male with a better genetic makeup than an average male. So those are the good genes that they mm-hmm. would get. That's a simple idea, that bright plumage would signal good genes, but it's turned out to be very difficult to test. But with these new techniques, the microarrays allow us to look at gene expression, which under different mm-hmm. conditions, which genes are expressed more or less. And that's by looking at which genes are turned on more or turned on less, it gives you clues about which genes are functioning. And so mm-hmm. using this kind of investigative technique, we're hoping we can find those genes that might be linked to bright plumage coloration. Or show that it doesn't work. I mean, we could falsify oh, yeah, the sure. hypothesis too. But one way or another, we want to know if good genes could be involved in this. So disease research has actually been a central yeah. theme of my lab's research. I also have a big, I play a large role in a study of encephalitis viruses,
mm-hmm.
and that has nothing to do with the plumage color work. That's sort of a whole separate issue. Just because of my skills in field ornithology, I was invited into a team of investigators looking at the ecology of encephalitis viruses, and my lab's part in that is to survey the birds in areas that are also being surveyed for mosquitoes and the virus, mm-hmm. and we're trying to figure out how these viruses mm-hmm. cycle in native ecosystems. So those are human diseases. That's West yeah. Nile virus we've gotten right. funding for, and Eastern equine encephalitis oh, yeah. virus, huh. which is a fairly rare human disease. It's deadly a lot of times when people get it, but it's mostly a horse disease. So there's a lot of interest in these encephalitis viruses in the mm-hmm. South from a human health perspective.
We just come out of a celebration of Darwin, and Darwin studied finches.
Yeah, also. That's right. Yeah.
And I mean, is the finch still evolving? I mean, I guess his was more the beak.
Oh,
he,
you
he
know,
watched, it, he watched it, the change in the beak or something, wasn't it?
That's right. Darwin, you know, that was actually Peter Grant,
who followed up
a couple generations later. Okay. Darwin didn't do much but just get stimulated in his thinking about the finches. Yeah, the Darwin story about the finches is, I think, always funny because when he was going around those islands making his collections, he wasn't even far enough along in his thinking to realize the value of labeling the finches to the islands he collected them on.
Mm.
So all Darwin's finches were labeled to the archipelago. He had them just to the Galapagos. It was actually the captain of the ship who was also making natural history collections. Everybody mm-hmm. seemed to collect natural history objects.
Yeah.
who actually properly labeled his specimens. And it was to those specimens Darwin had to go to make sure he remembered things correctly, that these guys actually sorted out by size and shape across the islands. And the irony of that story is Fitzroy, who was the captain, became one of the most ardent critics of Darwin's evolutionary theory when decades later, when they were all both back in England, and Fitzroy was just thought it was undermining all the teachings of the church, and so, but it was actually his collections that helped Darwin get his ideas straight about how the finches may have evolved. But absolutely, those finches are evolving, changing rainfall patterns, change seed distribution, and this modern researcher, Peter Grant, shown that they respond rapidly by changing, evolving new bill sizes to respond to the resource available.
We have, maybe you've seen it over in our on our new lab building, the bronze of Darwin, and it has the finches. The artist who did that took the finch to, I think, because they have almost four, five, or six finches there, each with a different bill size.
Changed. Darwin didn't get it at that early stage in his thinking and that early part of the trip. But by the time Darwin had gotten his idea for evolution by natural selection and how that would lead to speciation, he remembered those birds as being different on the different islands. But if he had relied on his own collection, it would have been a disaster because he had labeled them properly. But luckily somebody did. So,
well, you know, a couple of years ago now, I want to say maybe two or three, Jeff, you energized all of us here at Auburn. And I know our listeners and our alumni with your ivory bill research. And I think you mentioned in an email just the other day that you may be returning to do some more of that coming up soon. Yeah. What's the status on the ivory bill?
Well, just to bring some listeners up to date, in 2005, there was an announcement by the Lab of Ornithology at Cornell that ivory bills had been rediscovered in Arkansas. And this is a bird that had disappeared in North America in about 1935. It's a big, fantastic bird. So it was really exciting, the idea that this bird could have existed kind of unknown for a few decades and then reappeared in the 21st century. And so, like all ornithologists, we were excited about that. And a couple students and I decided to get out and look at some swamps south of Auburn just to see if the habitat looked good or what have you. And darned if we didn't discover ivory bills on the Florida Panhandle in the forest along the Choctahatchee River, which is a little-known river. I always say that, but you know, everybody knew the Choctahatchee was there. But in terms of ornithologists getting into the forest along the Choctahatchee, it hadn't been surveyed ever very well, and not for decades. And so, in these forests, we sighted ivory bill woodpeckers, and we made sound recordings of them. We found other evidence for these birds, and we even got a bad video of the birds. But everyone's been waiting for us to get really nice, clear, definitive evidence that the birds still exist in Florida, and we're still working on that. Like I said, we amassed a lot of evidence that these birds exist, but they're very elusive birds, and they've defied our efforts to get a clear still image or video of the birds. And so we're still set automated cameras that can go down into the swamp. These cameras are activated by vibration, so we put them on trees where we think the birds will come in to feed. And if something comes in and bangs on the tree, we get a picture of it. So we've gotten pictures of pileated woodpeckers, the smaller cousin of the ivory bill. The camera systems work, and you know, any day we could get an ivory bill picture. But now the problem is, in 2005, when we discovered these birds, we had a lot of chances to get pictures of them. We had found a place where these birds could be regularly relocated. And over a year, we found them quite regularly, about once a week or once every other week, we would have a sighting or an encounter with ivory bills. And I feel in a lot of ways, we just really missed our chance to get a picture of them back then. We didn't quite appreciate how hard it would be. We didn't do some things we should have done to get a picture. And now we've lost the birds. We've had no sightings or sound detections, any sort of detections, for a year. And the place where the birds used to be, they are not coming in anymore. And we just have to hope we'll hit another spot that they're using regularly and we can get our cameras up. But right now it's kind of just been a waiting game, trying to relocate the birds and get back on them.
I mean, could the mating pair have died off or something?
Yeah, I mean, there's lots of possibilities. It's possible it was down to the very last few birds and they're actually gone now. I think that's certainly a possibility. I think the chances of us coming on the ivory bill like at the last few months of its existence on Earth is pretty slim. And these birds have been elusive since the day we got in there. In other words, they don't want people anywhere near them. As far as we can tell, they're response to people is to go to the other side of these big trees that are, and they're in these dense forests, and fly directly away. And so they always put a tree between the observer and them, mm-hmm. always slip away. Probably 99% of the time, you don't see them. They just get away from you.
Sure.
The few times you see them, they're zipping through the forest as fast as they can to get away from you. So I think it's more likely that we're simply, we've lost track of where those birds are in that forest. Mm-hmm. We mostly go to the same spot all the time where they used to be, and they're not there anymore. So we're trying to fan out and find the areas.
Well, what about in Arkansas? Have people gone back in there and had some
Arkansas is an interesting situation because everybody, including the experts at Cornell, think the place where they had them, and actually had them in 2004, they didn't publish till 2005, was not a regular place for ivory bills. It's this little narrow strip of really beautiful habitat, but not very big. And for about 6 weeks in 2004, there seemed to be one bird regularly in that little patch of woods. It left, and now they don't know. They don't know if that bird was dispersing from far away. They never sighted more than one bird. It was always a male. And so that situation's really unclear what was going on. In the Choctahatchee, we had several sightings of two birds. We also have sound recordings that are two birds. So we know there were at least two birds in there. And we think it's a resident nesting population, maybe only two birds. I think it's more than that. I think it's two or three pairs. But it's a big area. They could shift around in that area. We're limited to public lands. We can't go on to the private lands. And it's only about 80% public in the flood forest. So these birds could just be in those patches 20% of the spot that we can't even enter at all. We only regularly cover a very small fraction of that forest. So there's lots of places for these birds to move.
That's a very exciting story. I remember when you came and first told me about it, I almost had chills as you were relating to me, your encounter with them.
I wish we had really finished the job back in 2006 when we really had a chance to get on them. And, you know, you always second guess yourself, but we could have gotten that picture that first year. Now it's a lot harder when you don't have any contact with the birds. It's a lot harder to get the picture. So,
Jeff has written a very engaging book on his experiences with the ivory bill. We'll post it as a show note for you, a link to his book, and I'm sure they can get it through Amazon. What we're doing with our books is we link Amazon. People just click right on the book link, and it takes them right to Amazon, and there you go. And I know they'd be interested in reading your book, Jeff. You know, we're talking about color. You and I, before we went into the podcast, there was an article in the New York Times, 2 weeks ago. It was on September the 1st, on first trace color found in fossil bird feathers. We can put this in a show note, too. Any comments you want to pass along on this article? It has to do with the fossil bird feathers, and since it's coloration.
I think it's a fun article. One of the things we always say when we're trying to talk about the evolution of colors is they don't fossilize. You just figure behaviors and colors don't leave a fossil record. Well, I can't say that anymore because these biologists have found evidence in bird fossils for coloration. And you say, well, how is the fossil actually colored? And no, there's no color in the fossil. But now that biologists have started to understand some of the mechanisms for creating color, and there's mechanisms besides just red pigments or yellow pigments. There's actually a way that birds can color their feathers by the way they construct the microstructures, the fine structures of the feathers, and biologists now understand that. And so by looking for those kind of fossilized microstructures in the feather, they were able to produce really good evidence that this particular bird had had an iridescent color display in its feathers. And it's funny, one of the real challenges here was distinguishing melanin granules, melanins would be pigment granules, from bacteria, because both are found on feathers in abundance, and they look amazingly alike. You think, well, how could you not tell a bacterium from a melanin? Well, it turns out, even for people that are experts on this, they look a lot alike. And what this research team did is they actually found a pattern across the feathers of striping, bands of these particles that makes perfect sense that the bird had a banded color pattern, but doesn't make any sense as far as bacteria. Mm-hmm. There's no reason bacteria would form these bands on a feather, but color patterns often mm-hmm. are banded. So that was their best evidence that this is coloration and not bacteria.
Yeah.
That it's another application of, really, I had a student in my lab. He actually won the Dean's Graduate Award, Matt Shockey.
Oh, yeah.
Who was doing, and Matt was doing studies on microstructures in living birds, how the feather structures create colors. And it's Matt's work and other people's work that laid the foundation for this kind of paleo work with colors.
Where you go from here? What's on your research list of, this is one thing I'd like to look more carefully into? Or
well, certainly there's a lot of things on the research list, but I've been doing more writing for non-scientists. Uh-huh. It's sort of part of my outreach duty. We hadn't talked about outreach, but I feel a real dedication to getting the results of our research out to mm-hmm. people that would be interested in it, who didn't go into science as their profession. And the nice thing about being an ornithologist is mm-hmm. you have this connection to a huge number of people that are non-scientist bird enthusiasts. Mm-hmm. And so these are highly educated people, a lot of them, doctors, lawyers, from every segment of society, who just have a love for birds. Our bird watchers and birders and backyard feeder watchers. And so I just completed, or I am just in the last days of completing, a new book with National Geographic that's a summary of not just my work, but all the work to date on bird coloration. And being produced by National Geographic, the target audience is birders, but also anybody who has an interest in birds. And this is a highly illustrated, very thorough coverage of bird coloration. But we really tried to limit the jargon and the being overly technical and just get to the main points with bird coloration. So that's been a big project. I have a few other book projects that are likely to come to pass in the next few years. But that National Geographic book should be out in bookstores in March. And it should be widely available.
I've never met anyone who didn't like birds.
Yeah,
it's a great. It's a natural. It's a. I mean, as organisms on this planet, we are attracted to other living organisms, mm-hmm. not just humans. But there will be people who don't care for snakes. There are people who don't
spiders.
Like
spiders. Spiders are a big thing this weekend. It seems like
or
everybody
frogs,
was
or people who,
spiders.
For some reason, don't like the big giant cats, or they don't like canines, or but everybody likes birds. And what a neat way for you to make a connection with the non-scientists, because as scientists, we all almost have a moral responsibility to make the non-science community aware of science. And so how do we relate them to it? And birds is a great way to
it's
do that.
It's absolutely critical. And so I had written this two-volume compendium on bird coloration that was certainly not meant for the lay public. Mm-hmm. It's difficult for the grad students to get through it. Really, you have to have training in biology and chemistry, maybe even physics, to get through a lot of these chapters, and we have mathematical models, and it's all heavily cited into the technical literature. And that's really what stimulated my interest in this new book, because you finish that book and it serves a real purpose in summarizing information for scientists, creating a foundation that future research launches from. But it's completely inaccessible to all these bird lovers, literally millions of bird lovers. Sure. And so what I did is I basically rewrote that technical volume in a much more user-friendly format, mm-hmm. which was really very enjoyable for me. I don't change the ideas. It's actually the new book is complete. It just takes out the jargon, technical aspects of it, and just explains it in a more basic term, with lots of color photographs. Mm-hmm. That's what's really great too.
Oh, yeah, sure.
With bird coloration, what kind of topic would need color illustrations more than bird coloration?
Well, I've heard some of your lectures for general audience, and so I think you have a talent to deliver that to the general public, and that is the connection of science. You know, you mentioned something there that I think is also valuable from how you approach your work, and that is how multidisciplinary it is, not just as an ornithologist or on a bigger scale a biologist, but an organismal biologist, but you mentioned chemistry and physics and mathematic modeling. I mean, you touch on all these disciplines, which so many students, when they come to the university, look at a curriculum and wonder why am I right. doing those things when I want to be an ornithologist, or when I want to be a physical chemist, or when I want to be a quantum mechanics
exactly.
person, you know. And that's, I think your research certainly touches on all of those and is a very meaningful illustration for our students. Jeff, before we bring this to a close, maybe there's something you had on your mind. Gee, maybe when I get on that podcast, we can talk about this. I don't want to leave our listeners without giving you that opportunity. Is there something else maybe you don't want to talk about?
Oh, well, we covered the book that's coming out. I think we covered most of the topics that I had brought to the meeting.
Well, and as I said just a few minutes ago, birds is something all of us enjoy watching. Their colorations and their feeding habits and their nesting habits, and there's some on the ground, some are on the trees. It's an interesting thing for all of us. Well, I bring this podcast to a close. Jeff, I appreciate you joining us for episode number 12 for the week of September 14. I want to tell all of our audience that this is you're listening to this podcast when my sidekick here, Philip Coxwell, is now a newly married man. He's joined us, married guys. He was married on September the 12th, so all of you out there celebrate for him this week while he's away. I will probably be soloing the next podcast until Philip returns, but Philip, we appreciate your being with us here every week and steering this podcast. So again, thanks for being with us. It's always good to have COSAM people out there listening to us, sharing this wonderful opportunity the College of Science and Mathematics offers our students and our community, and to be part of the Auburn University family and team. So again, thanks for being with us. Thanks for clicking on us, and we'll see you next time.